Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenen and I'm here with co-host Jeff Pitino.
How are you?
And we're the guys that talk about ancient civilizations and the idea that civilization may have moved in this vast cycle of time with alternating dark and golden ages as taught by really the ancients themselves. This has been documented by Giorgio De Santayana, the former professor of the history of science at MIT, and it's a common belief amongst ancient cultures, and yet it's something that modern historians really don't accept today. And so the idea today is that the farther back in time you go, the more primitive something must be. And yet we're finding more and more evidence of the opposite. Indeed, when you go far back before the Dark Ages, we're finding some rather amazing things. And so it's our pleasure and privilege to get to interview a lot of experts in this field. And our expert today is David Hatcher Childress, who is known as the real-life Indiana Jones. And tell us a little bit more about him, Jeff.
Well, you're right. David is known as the real-life Indiana Jones to the many fans of his books. And he's also a captivating speaker, and he's written over 15 books. And he's also traveled the world several times over. And for more than 20 years, he's been investigating the subjects of ancient cultures and ancient civilization. And he's also been on television several times, including Fox's Sightings and Encounters, two NBC specials, The Conspiracy Zones, and segments for the Discovery Channel, A&E, and the History Channel.
And he's particularly well-known for this Lost Cities series, which is one of the things that first caught my eye about David's work, which talks about his adventures around the globe and some of the very ancient cultures that he's visited. So, David, you on the line?
Yeah. How you guys?
Howdy. Terrific to have you here, and love to hear about your latest adventures, particularly your latest book, The Mystery of the Olmec. How'd you get going on that?
You know, I've always been fascinated with the Olmecs, and I love going down to Mexico. I just got back from there a few days ago, in fact, and my new book, The Mystery of the Olmecs, has been out about 6 months. Today, they're saying that everything that we had earlier ascribed to the Mayans having invented, including the number system, hieroglyphs, the building of pyramids, even the ball game and the rubber balls, were really invented by these mysterious people before the Mayans, called the Olmecs.
Even the ball game, because that's like basic Mayan iconography, isn't it? I mean, that's...
Well, yeah, and you know, the ball game is a fascinating study in itself. And I'm right now, you know, talking to you from northern Arizona, and it's curious that we think of the ball games as being a Mayan and now an Olmec game. The Aztecs and the Toltecs, Mixtecs, the Zapotecs, they all played the game. But these ball courts also exist in northern Arizona, as far north as the Grand Canyon and around there and around Phoenix as well. And even the rubber balls were traded from Central America, and they have to come from that area. But they were brought all the way up into Arizona, and the mysterious Hohokam Native Americans who vanished, they built ball courts and concrete-lined canals. The city of Phoenix still uses some of these ancient canals today. And who those people were, we don't know, but somehow connected to the Toltecs and ultimately to the Mayans and the Olmecs.
Yeah, that's always amazed me about Phoenix, that these developments they keep doing, they keep running into these old canals or, you know, structures from long, long before the white men got there.
Well, right. And, I mean, what's kind of interesting, too, is concrete is such a brilliant sort of invention, pouring liquid stone, and we use it so much today. But the Romans used concrete, the Mayans used concrete, and basically these Hohokam Indians, whoever they were, we don't even know, they use concrete too, and they built three-story concrete houses all around Phoenix and the Casa Grande area.
Okay, well, let's talk more about that since we get back. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. David, you mentioned that the Olmec predate the Maya culture, and there's evidence going on up into the Americas. And, you know, when I think of the Olmec, I think of these big, giant heads, which I saw one in the museum. I couldn't believe it, how massive this thing was. And is there anything like that that comes after them?
Well, you know, there are other megalithic ruins in Mexico and Central America. Monte Albán near Oaxaca is megalithic, and Mitla, which is also nearby. But those colossal heads that you're talking about, which is one of the most recognizable icons of the Olmecs, those giant heads, they're called colossal heads. They're made out of basalt. They weigh up to 20 tons apiece. Basalt's extremely hard rock, difficult to carve, and heavy as well. And those heads, they look like Nigerian football players.
Yeah, that's, again, I've noticed that. They do not have typical Mexican features.
And that's one of the interesting things about the Olmecs especially, is that the Olmecs, much like America, appears to be some kind of melting pot of different cultures and races from around the world. And when you look at Olmec statuary and paintings and pottery and things, you see people who are apparently from Africa. You see people who are very Oriental. I mean, they look exactly as we would think of Chinese people and other East Asians. Other Olmecs, though, appear to be Mediterranean, Phoenician, or Jewish, or Roman.
And some have facial hair and beards.
That's right, heavy beards and heavy mustaches. And by the way, American Indians do not have facial hair. And this is one of the things, too, with certain Toltec and Mayan statuary as well, where some of these guys have thick mustaches, thick beards, and would appear to be Caucasians or something, like from the Eastern Mediterranean. And, you know, still other Olmecs look Native American, as the Mayans generally do.
So obviously this doesn't fit the standard archaeological theory that whoever peopled America originally was Mongoloids that came up over the Siberian land bridge. Because you seem to have different ethnic types here.
Well, right. And, I mean, this is one of the problems with the Olmecs is they particularly would seem to cast doubt on this popular theory that all Native Americans are descended somehow from Ice Age hunters who've crossed from Siberia into Alaska and Canada, then moved down, you know, over time into Central America, and then ultimately to South America, and that this is the origin of all of these natives. And when you're looking at
that requires very similar features.
Well, right, and it's difficult for these mainstream archaeologists to explain Negroid features. Very Chinese features, also Eastern Mediterranean, Caucasian-type features, when, in fact, they're saying, oh, all these guys somehow walked, you know, from Siberia. And at that point, you're saying, so all these Negroes walked across Siberia and all that kind of stuff, too? And actually, the mainstream archaeologists are saying that. They're saying, yes, that's right. But they just look
Africans,
you know.
Then we should find them along the way.
You know, that's part of the thing with Kennewick Man up in Washington State that became exactly along this, where a road crew in Washington was digging out a highway, found some skeleton that was over 10,000 years old, and so suddenly they had, hey, here's one of these early Native American guys who walked across the Bering Strait, supposedly. Let's, you know, examine him. But as they did that, they found out that he was not an Asian. He was a Caucasian guy. And this immediately cast doubt on the prevalent theories and things like that. I mean, part of the whole thing, and this is something I'm constantly stressing, and when I argue with the mainstream archaeologists, which I do a lot, is that this concept that oceans are barriers, and that, you know, ancient people can't get into boats and cross the Atlantic or the Pacific. They have to walk everywhere.
And yet you've got the Polynesians who managed to find tiny islands in the middle of the Pacific.
With canoes.
And who's to say, oh, they made it two-thirds of the way across to Hawaii. Why wouldn't they make it, like, the other third?
Well, exactly. And, in fact, islands like Hawaii and Easter Island are some of the most remote islands in the world. The Hawaiian Islands are extremely remote. So the same thing with Madagascar. I mean, the ancient Malaysians and Indonesians crossed the Indian Ocean to Madagascar. There's not a bunch of islands there either. So what mainstream archaeologists are saying is that, yes, primitive Stone Age people, like the Polynesians and Malaysians, they can get into their giant double canoes, colonize islands that are thousands of miles from anywhere. That's okay. But sophisticated civilizations with sophisticated navies, like the ancient Chinese, the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Romans, Greeks, ancient Hindus and Buddhists in Asia, they can't go out in their giant navies and, you know, go to islands and cross oceans. No, they have to walk everywhere.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
I mean, it's unscientific. I mean, and if, when you look at that, especially that argument right there, I mean, the idea that oceans are not barriers, oceans are highways. The easy way to go from China to South America or Mexico is not to walk there through thousands of miles of hostile tribes and stuff. The easy way to go to these places is in a boat. I mean, teenagers have crossed oceans in small boats by themselves. People have rowed across the Atlantic. People have taken kayaks across the Atlantic. This French guy a couple of years ago swam across the Atlantic. So, you know, that the Egyptians, the Romans, the Greeks, Irish or Basque for that matter, you know, they cannot get into their ships and cross oceans.
Right. Well,
Columbus's
just
ships were much smaller than any naval ships of the Chinese or the, you know, Hindus or even the Egyptians.
Yeah, well, it just points out that we need a major rethink in mainstream archaeology, and of course that's what we're both beating our drum on here for years. Hey, how did you get interested in this whole field in the first place? What personally led you to, you know, go against the grain, so to speak?
Well, you know, I'm an American, but I was born in France, and my parents are Americans. And I was fortunate that my father and my mother loved to travel. I grew up in Colorado and was very much a outdoors skier, camper, mountain climber guy, and did a lot of hiking with my parents. My father was a lawyer and would go to conventions, so we would go to England, to Stonehenge, to Turkey, to Greece, to Mexico. And fortunately, my parents dragged my brother and I along with them. And so at an early age, I was traveling around the world, climbing pyramids, introduced to the wonderful world of museums and the fascinating things in them. And at the same time, you know, I was growing up in 1960s America, watching Johnny Quest cartoons and things like that, and I, Ripley's Believe It or Not, I was always interested in. And yet, you know, I find too, as you travel around the world, and I very early on got the travel bug, wanted to go to Tibet and Mount Everest to paddle up the Amazon and find lost cities. And you know, I think that's the dream of many many young people who want to go out, have adventure, have exciting Indiana Jones, you know, kind of experiences.
Most don't do it, though.
That's right. And I was fortunate to actually get out there and do it. I worked my way around the world. I started by teaching English in Taiwan and Hong Kong. At that time, I was a technical mountain climber, and I wanted to go to the Himalayas and go climbing, which I did. I had dual interests in esoteric things like Tibet and ancient history and stuff like that. Once I got going, it was hard to stop. I learned how to travel very cheaply. I became one of the original sort of $5-a-day backpackers around the world. I would take trains and buses. I hitchhiked some places. I went through Afghanistan and Iran back in the 70s, when you could actually
when
still
it was
travel
still okay. Well, we're glad you did, because you've turned out just a tremendous series of books here that give us some look at not only these countries, but the ancient cultures that we find in many of these places. And I just wanted to remind our listeners that those that have an interest in some of David's books, including his most recent, The Mystery of the Olmec, you can get those at adventuresunlimited.com. Is that right, David?
Yeah, adventuresunlimitedpress.com.
Press.com.
And you would see all of our books and DVDs available there. We also have a magazine called World Explorer, and it's all about unusual archaeological things and world travel and adventures, some cryptozoology in there as well, and that has its own web pages, which is wexclub.com, the World Explorers Club, wexclub.com. So that's an easier site to get to.
Great.
Rather than having the world's longest URL.
That's right. Well, okay. We couldn't use AdventuresUnlimited.com because there was a balloon adventure company had already taken.
Okay. Also, I wanted to remind our listeners that David will be a speaker at CPAC this year. That's the Conference on Procession and Ancient Knowledge, which will be held at UCSD on October 4th.
4th and 5th.
That's right. Okay. And you can go to cpaconline.com to get more information.
And that's cpaconline.com.
Right. We just have about a minute left in this segment, but I also understand beyond ancient cultures, David, you have an interest in some of the work of Nikola Tesla.
Yes. And with Adventures Unlimited, I mean, a lot of our books and DVDs are about archaeology and ancient history, but we're also very interested in alternative science, particularly Tesla-type stuff. And I'm the editor, too, of a bunch of books on anti-gravity, free energy-type devices, time travel, and a lot of that, too, kind of spills over. Into,
well, if we're right
UFO.
About ancient cultures, that they really were more advanced than we think, then maybe all those things go together quite well. You're listening to Cosmic Influence with our guest today, David Hatcher Childress. We'll be right back. David, one of your top-selling books must have been Technology of the Gods. At least I've seen that name around so many times. And in there, you really raised some fascinating ideas about ancient cultures, that they may have had things that definitely mainstream science today wouldn't allow, such as these Vimanas flying machines. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, yeah. That book, Technology of the Gods, is probably my most popular book, and it's been translated into the most foreign languages. There's Korean and Chinese, French, German, Polish, Romanian editions of that book. And throughout that book, I am trying to raise the bar on what ancient civilizations were like. Part of the whole thing, too, is that it's a concept that, civilization is this straight line graph from, caveman, just draw a straight line up to the top corner of the graph, and here's modern man. But that's, you know, that's not history. History is really this roller coaster graph of ups and downs, much like you say, of ages of enlightenment and science and knowledge, but then juxtaposed with dark ages and entire crashings of civilizations. And throughout Technology of the Gods, I go into this. I use a lot of ancient Vedic texts. I lived in India for some years and was always fascinated by that. When you read the ancient Sanskrit texts like the Mahabharata, the Ramayana is part of that, other books like the Drona Parva, when you read them, I mean, they read like the wildest science fiction. It's like Buck Rogers or Flash Gordon. These guys are flying around in their flying machines called Vimanas. They're fighting horrific wars. They're destroying cities from the air in their Vimanas and things like that. I mean, it really is pretty fantastic. And people, archaeologists, completely just wrote this off as some kind of ancient fantasy. But what happened was, in the late 1940s, when British and Pakistani and English Kodiji and the Gujarat, what they found was that, like the ancient Indian epics had indicated, there had been these horrific wars. And at places like Mohenjo-Daro, people were just lying dead in the streets, holding hands. This doom had just taken over these cities, and no one had buried the dead or anything. And then the deserts had just come in and buried these cities. These cities were also highly sophisticated. They were built out of bricks, very high-quality, uniform bricks. They had good sanitation, sewage systems, good water systems. They were pre-planned cities. And then totally destroyed.
Right. They have their own language that has still not been deciphered. A lot of these bricks were not only uniform in size, but they sort of fit this this golden mean ratio. I wrote about these also in my book, Lost Star of Myth and Time, Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. And, they just completely disappear, and then were not touched for thousands and thousands of years.
Well, and the way they discovered these cities originally was that they were building some railroads in Pakistan, and they needed ballast for the railway line, and the natives were going over into the desert and bringing back these very high-quality uniform bricks to build up the railway tracks. And then finally British archaeologists and people said, "Where are you getting these bricks?" And they're like, "Oh, from this lost city over here," and that's how they were discovered. It's interesting, too, with the Vimanas, because the ancient Indian epics would talk about these Vimanas. And, in fact, even today, if you go to India, Southeast Asia, ask any Hindu or Buddhist what a Vimana is, they know. They all know what Vimanas are. Vimanas are these airships that people flew around in. And just like if you're going to read a modern novel today, the author may suddenly say, the hero jumps on a British Airways jet, he flies to Switzerland, whatever. But the novelist isn't going to suddenly stop and tell you what an airplane is and describe it and how it works and, how the seating is and all these little things. He knows that you know what an airplane is. He just has to mention it, and you can picture it in your mind. Well, that's how the ancient Indian epics were written, too, where they would talk about these Vimanas, but they wouldn't go into great detail about what they were. But finally, in 1908, in the Royal Baroda Library in central India, this ancient manuscript was found, written in archaic Sanskrit. It was from the 4th century B.C. The manuscript itself said it was taken from earlier books, and it was an entire book only about Vimanas.
Amazing.
The book itself mentions 4 or 5 different kinds of Vimanas. It talks about what apparently is electricity. It goes into the pilots, metals. Mercury is part of it. Even talks about aerial warfare and things like that. and it was basically this entire manual for these ancient aircraft. And there weren't any illustrations or anything in it, but Indian scholars, starting in 1908, began poring over this book. We reprint the entire text in English in our book, Vimana Aircraft of Ancient India and Atlantis.
Oh, excellent. I'll have to check that out myself because
yes.
I've heard a lot about it, but I've never read a firsthand account.
When I go in my book on technology of the gods, I do have an entire chapter about Vimanas. We don't reproduce the entire text of the Vimana Shastra in that book. But it really kind of makes sense, and though it seems so far-fetched to people today that the ancient world would have had electricity, and you need that. In Technology of the Gods, I talk about how in order to really have technical devices, you need metals, you need electricity, and then you need concepts of making cogged wheels. You have also the famous Antikythera device, which was found in 1900 in a shipwreck.
Before we go over to the Mediterranean, I just wanted to say the Vedic Indians, they also gave us this backdrop for a context for these higher age things, which is, of course, their concept of the yugas with the Satya, Treta, Dwapara, and the lowest yuga, the Kali Yuga.
Right.
Anyway, you're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back. So you mentioned the Antikythera device. This is something many of us have talked about at CPAC, and of course it's about 2,000 years out of context. Tell us a little bit about it from your perspective.
Yeah, you know, you can see the Antikythera device in the museum in Athens today, and it's got its own special display. Yeah, what's so curious about the Antikythera device was that until that was discovered in 1900, and it wasn't until 1950s that American archaeologists really began to study the device and X-ray it, and it was a Scientific American article in 1950s that really, you know, kind of just blew the lid off that. I mean, they said then in that article that finding the Antikythera device was like finding a jet plane in the tomb of King Tut, because here was a sophisticated computer with hundreds of cogged wheels and interlocking
precision cogged wheels. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it was more complicated than any, you know, Swiss clock or from the 1800s. I mean, it, and in fact, what they finally discovered that it was a computer that could be dialed up, you know, as constellations and things like that. It was apparently used for navigation.
Yeah, it has the gear ratios of the planet's orbits. For example, the moon goes around the Earth 13 times every year, but we only see 12 full moons because, of course, the Earth's moving at the same time. And they have that 12-13 ratio. And so by looking at all these ratios, they were able to figure out that this thing can plot the movements of the planets as well as anything done during Kepler's time.
Well, right. And it really what it showed archaeologists, you know, as they studied it, was that, and what blew their minds was that they never, ever imagined that ancient people had, you know, machines like this, technical kind of gizmos, and even the interest to do that. I mean, they didn't think that they could even knew basic navigation like that. So it just blew all of their previous assumptions out of the water, that here was absolute evidence that ancient man had a higher technology than we'd ever credit them with. A similar thing happened with Stonehenge. And in the 1960s, you had Gerald Hawkins writing his famous book, Stonehenge Decoded. And in that book, too, he was basically saying, look, Stonehenge is an astronomical computer. It can predict eclipses.
Right, using the blue stones, right?
Yeah, all this kind of stuff. And immediately, again, the mainstream archaeologists, and these are the guys, you know, at Oxford, at Harvard, at Yale, they're immediately saying, no, this can't. people just couldn't have built something or had that kind of knowledge back then. We won't give them that credit.
Despite the fact that they were able to move massive stones hundreds of miles just to get them in place.
You know, and that's part of it, too. And it's something that I point out in all my books and in Technology of the God, is that why do people move giant blocks of stone, like at Stonehenge in South America on Easter Island? Why build out of 20-ton, 100-ton blocks of stone when, you know, you don't have to do that? You don't have to go around moving stones the size of a semi-truck around.
I know. It must be because they were so primitive they didn't know how to use bricks.
Well, and that's the odd thing with megalithic construction, is that often the oldest walls, the oldest construction, is the biggest. I mean, it's the Fred Flintstone conundrum or something. Ancient people, they wanted to build out of 50-ton blocks of stone, but we don't do that today. And this is the thing, too, is that archaeologists and Egyptologists, these people, they're not engineers. They're not architects. Go to the Great Pyramid. Go to walls in Peru or Nan Madal on this remote island in the Pacific. Go there with an architect. Go there with an engineer and ask them how they would make these things. Ask them how primitive or sophisticated people would move these things around, stack these giant blocks up in walls. Egyptologists, because they're not engineers or architects, they say, oh, yeah, well, a bunch of slaves just dragged these blocks up there, stacked them up, blah, blah, blah. Pharaoh told them to. But the engineers are scratching their head going, oh, man, we don't know how they could possibly have done that.
Yeah,
and I mean,
no, there's a real conflict there. And we've had, Graham Hancock, John Anthony West, Robert Bovall, all those guys on the show and looking at this from different perspective, and everybody just shakes their head.
Well, and that's kind of, we were talking about, people traveling around the world on boats rather than having to walk everywhere. And it's the same thing. You know, why are you going to build out of megalithic blocks when you could build out of much smaller, easier to move blocks of stone? You could still make very nice walls and things. I mean, and people do. But for some reason, they wanted to build out of 50-ton blocks, and it perfectly stacked up, Baalbek and stuff like that. And you have to wonder, was it really hard for them to do it, or was it somehow easy? I mean, and that's, to me, that's what makes most sense, is that if you're going to build out of giant megalithic blocks, it's probably because it's not that hard for you to do. But as we look at it, it seems impossibly difficult.
Right. Also, there might be some other purpose to it. One of our guests that's been on the show here and a very popular CPAC speaker is John Burke. He wrote a book called Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. And he's a scientist, and he's taken electrostatic voltmeters and flux magnetometers to over 80 megalithic sites. And what he found at Avebury, for example, is just mind-blowing. He took over 1,000 readings with a flux magnetometer, found that those stones there, all stones have a polarity when they're formed by the Earth, positive being when they were pointed towards the North Pole, negative towards the South Pole. Somehow the ancients were able to figure out the polarity of all those stones, the 66 remaining stones that he tested, and align them so that they all are aligned by their magnetism. So all the positive sides face in one direction and the negative in the other. And so it looks like a huge particle accelerator, something like CERN. But we have no idea how they knew or why they did it. And that's, of course, still a mystery today.
Yeah, right. That's fascinating. I mean, and why – that's kind of the thing that archaeologists should be asking themselves. Why are people doing this? Why are they building in such a difficult way?
Well, let's try to answer that question then as soon as we come back from the break. You're listening to Cosmic Influence.
And welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host Walter Cruttenden and our guest today, David Hatcher-Childress.
And we're just talking about why this sort of enigma exists. And I don't think we have the answers as to why the ancients did these things, at least not yet. But as to why modern archaeologists won't believe that they had some knowledge that we don't, I think it's just because this Darwinian paradigm is so strong that if you start accepting that mankind long ago knew a lot of things that we didn't know, then it blows this whole theory that, you know, things have to be so linear.
But, well, right. And it, every theory, you know, has to start with some basic assumptions. And unfortunately, with modern archaeologists, I mean, they begin with this basic assumption that man is primitive and didn't know what we know, that and didn't even have the same curiosity and inventiveness that we have. Yet ancient people, I mean, this is, again, a paradox that people like us, supposedly, by, again, mainstream science is saying, yeah, for the last 100,000 years, Homo sapiens, Cro-Magnon man like us, and in fact, an ancient man was taller than us and had a bigger brain. But yet, supposedly, you know, he just sat in his little cave for 95,000 years without doing anything. And then suddenly, everyone got out of their cave, started building roads and bridges and ziggurats and giant pyramids and port cities and stuff like that. But it all just happened, you know, a few thousand years ago.
Yeah,
but that's, I mean, and that's what's so wrong. Modern archaeologists continually pushing back history, back beyond 10,000 years ago. The city Jericho, cities like Kettle Hayuk and things like that.
Turkey,
and,
right.
And it's how far, so the idea is, okay, sure, 15,000 years ago, man was building big cities, giant walls. Did he have metals? Electricity is one of the big questions, and that's and naturally a very controversial one. But you have things like the Baghdad Battery. I mean, we know that the ancients had electricity. I mean, that's a fact now, but how much?
No, the battery wasn't invented until Volta in the 1700s. So, yeah, these things are so conflicting, and it just shows us we need a new context to put them in. And I keep saying, what better context than the ancients themselves gave us, which is the idea of a great year. Over 30 ancient cultures believe that civilization, consciousness, if you will, waxes and wanes in conjunction with stellar movements. You know, they were all just fascinated in watching the stars. And it's the only way I can make sense out of why so many ancient civilizations declined into that worldwide dark age.
And, you know, the ancients, like you say, they were fanatical star watchers. And the movement of the planets, astrology, eclipses, all that stuff, they monitored it. Incredibly minutely, and the more you look at the Mayans, the Egyptians, all cultures, their fanatical devotion to watching the stars is curious. I mean, they were utterly obsessed with it.
Right, and they understood many celestial concepts that Western science has only recently understood. For example, the Maya knew about the movements of Venus, which the Western science really didn't have those well timed until about the 1700s or so. And,
right.
And this whole precession of the equinox, you know, that's of course the topic of my book Lost Our Myth and Time, but it's something they seem to be extremely well aware of, tied this rise and fall of civilization to precession, and I think we're going to find that their interpretation of what was going on there is better than the modern Western view.
Well, when you look at Vedic culture and, say, the Mayans and the Mayan calendar, which is a hot topic these days, but, I mean, they themselves project time and their calendar, the early cycles back many thousands and thousands and thousands of years. The yuga cycles go back an incredible amount of time. And you would think that, you know, their obsession with these ancient dates might have actually something to do with their own real history, rather than just projecting everything back into time, which is what the mainstream would say, is that, yeah, I mean, these people didn't exist, they didn't even, you know, but suddenly, for some reason, they want to, like the Mayans, they want to start their calendar at over 3,000 BC, but, you know, the archaeologists saying that the Mayans weren't around then.
Yeah, well, maybe it's just an elaborate hoax amongst all these cultures that weren't able to talk with each other.
They all got together in 2000 BC and put together this plan for the future.
Yeah.
Well, and that's part of the same thing, too, with we're talking about oceans being highways rather than barriers and things. But mainstream archaeologists maintain that all these cultures are totally separated from each other. Pyramids in the Pacific or Central America or South America have nothing to do with pyramids in Africa or Asia. The largest pyramid in the world is actually in China. How about that?
I know you've been a lot of places, but you haven't seen the White Pyramids, have you?
An interesting subject. And, yeah, the giant pyramid, the White Pyramid, that's supposedly somewhere in northern Burma, eastern Tibet, that this flyer saw during World War II. And that is different than the Siam Pyramids, which are also huge earth pyramids.
I see, okay.
But the White Pyramid is a supposedly a gleaming stone pyramid in the jungle somewhere. And I talk about that a little bit in my book, Lost Cities of China, Central Asia, and India.
Yeah. Well, we're getting near the end of the show here, David, but just wanted to remind our listeners that they can get information on your books at AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com, correct?
That's right. Yeah, AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com. You can see our online catalog, and we import books and things as well. And we have our magazine, which is called World Explorer Magazine, and that's part of our club, which we call the World Explorers Club. It's a magazine all about ancient mysteries and archaeology, some cryptozoology. And we have a website for that, too, which is called wexclub.com. We use World Explorers Club. We use Wex as our shortened version.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you being on the show. We're looking forward to seeing you at CPAC this fall. And once again, thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We barely scratched the surface with David Hatcher Childress's work. For those of you that are more interested, we invite you to come to CPAC this year, where David will be talking about the Olmec specifically, and many of our other speakers will be talking about other ancient cultures, including the matriarchal cultures throughout Europe, and we're going to put them all in a context that makes sense. And you can read a little bit about this in our book, Lost Star of Myth and Time, that Jeff and I worked on, and this really gives an overview of the ancient view of civilization and history in general.
It really does. And if you want more information on CPAC, our conference coming up October 4th and 5th, you can get that at our website, www.cpaconline.com. That's CPAKonline.com.
In the meantime,
bring on the higher ages.